The audience matters, obviously. Usually I'm teaching high school class or middle school or something like that, and you have to kind of temper a lot of things that you say, because, you know, a lot of times these kids are still taking in a little bit of milk, and so it's a rare occasion that you can come in front of a group of men and men only, and have some discussions, some frank discussions, because even in a Sunday morning, or you know, when you have various age groups and even in a mixed audience, men and women communicate quite differently, and you know, like, for, you know, and so I'm always amazed that, you know, Brent and you guys and Ruben, that's something that's tough to always have to go out and talk to a mixed gender audience. To, you know, so you have to temper yourself and weigh your words a little bit, as to not offend or trample over, turn off the female audience, while at the same time being direct enough to where your male audience can hear, because we communicate much differently. Like, for example, you know, just on Sunday, I was like, Jen, where would you like to eat? And she said, I don't know. What are some options? I don't know. You want to do like Panera Bread or Salada, or, and she'll say something like, did we have Salada last week? I don't know. Now, to the untrained man and to the single man, they don't realize that she actually answered the question just then. But it takes some years and some experience to realize that she did, in fact, answer the question. To most men, or, and even you might, well, when does she answer the question? Well, she answered the question by saying, by layering it and saying, well, didn't we have that last week? And then, so therefore, I don't want to have that again. And shouldn't you know? And shouldn't you remember that we had that last week? And I want you to realize that I want something else other than that. So, whereas a guy just wants to hear an answer, now I want Salada. I want, you know. And so these are the differences, you know, one of the many differences between a male audience and a male-female audience, and really a difference between gender. I was noticing, I thought of something the other day, especially in today's society, that originally Satan's first lie was about the creator, and that kind of lasted for several thousand years, where he could say, well, you know, this creator's kind of holding you guys down, and he's doing this, and we'll talk about that in a little bit, but as we move into a post-Christian society, and frankly a post-God society, I think what the lie is now is more about creation itself. What you see is, you know, what is the difference between, you know, biological differences between us? What is the nature of his actual creation? And you see that a lot. All right. So my talk is supposed to be about vanity. So it's coming from Ecclesiastes and Ecclesiastes 1. And I think, being the first speaker, I think it wouldn't, you know, you don't want to wrap everything up or step on anybody's toes. So what I was thinking about was that first chapter, and he's talking about this vanity, this emptiness, and he's going through you know, just the wording is really incredible in chapter 1. You know, what profit has a man from all his labor, which he toils in his hand? One passes away, another one comes. Sun rises, sun goes down. There's no remembrance of former things. And so, you know, this is a familiar passage to us, and then everybody kind of likes to skip to the end of the book. But I think on something like this, in this meeting here, I think one of the things that you have to do is you have to think about, you know, not just what to do, but how did we get there? And not how we got there and how we get there today only, but also how Solomon got there and how that relates to us. Solomon is somebody who, you know, is kind of almost a larger-than-life figure. I find myself, when I'm reading about characters in the Old and New Testament, sometimes you'll see a guy and you can kind of relate to him, somebody like Peter or something like that, or or maybe even Paul, but Thomas definitely I can relate to. But Solomon is a character. He's so larger than life, really. I mean, he was so much more successful than any of us could ever imagine. He had more opportunities than anybody, and so he was somebody that it's almost hard to wrap your head around him. So how does somebody with so much opportunity, so much wealth, so much wisdom, and wisdom that came directly from God, how is it that he could write something like we read there in chapter 1? It doesn't take long for me to realize where he went off. If you turn over to chapter 2 and go down, starting about verse 4, you'll see this. And when I started this thought process, I wanted to familiarize myself in the passage. And one of the things I like to do is I like to listen to the Bible on the way to work. You know, you can knock out a few chapters and things like that. And it was one of these things when I was listening to it, it's something that I may not have read in this way initially, but when I heard it spoken this way, it really jumped out at me. Look at chapter 2, verse 4. I made my works great. I built myself houses. I planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards, and I planted all kinds of fruits and trees in them. I made myself water pools. And he goes on and on. I acquired, I also gathered for myself silver and gold. I think what I started to realize is, and what I kind of want to convey tonight is that Solomon's problem could have arisen from an ideology that we often suffer from today. I don't know if anybody remembers, how many of you were here when I spoke Sunday morning a couple months ago? And if you guys remember, one of the things I was trying to convey, and probably not very well, but one of the things I had mentioned was this idea, this ideology of tolerance, and how it could be destructive in our society. Because once you idolize an ideal like tolerance, well, then it trumps every other ideology, and therefore the only thing that could be viewed as morally reprehensible would be intolerance. And so the very fact that we read the Bible that gives right and wrong, and you know, then all of a sudden we're in a trap, right? And you see that a lot. But I want to say something that's probably, and I think everybody here is comfortable with that concept, but I wanted to bring up a concept that might be a little bit more troublesome for you, for particularly this audience, to think about as another ideology that can be just as dangerous. And that is the ideology of freedom. And I realize my audience, I realize what's coming up in 2 weeks. And there's an old story about John Wesley, and he was, I guess when he was sending out his preachers early on, one of the stories they said about him was that, you know, people would come back and say, "Well, what did you convert anybody?" And if they said no, you know, and people said, "Well, did you make anybody angry?" You know, and that was kind of like, you know, at least make somebody feel uncomfortable. And so when I thought about this idea of freedom, I figured it might make some of us feel uncomfortable. It certainly made me feel uncomfortable thinking about it. But freedom is not the only value like tolerance. And if you think about the way we kind of conceptualize freedom as an ideology, Solomon was the freest man to ever live. He had absolute freedom from any type of government interference, from any tyranny. He was the king. He had no restraints when it came to material wealth. He had complete sexual freedom. He wasn't bound by what many people call the confines of our monogamous marriages and things like that. The modern meaning of the word freedom, he was absolutely free. And that's because in this way, this term that we use has been redefined. And one of the things I've heard said before, and it really got to me, if you want to change a society, you change the meaning of words. And think about what that means, the tolerance word, the love word. Think about how the word family has been reconstructed in today's society. Justice, how has that been reconstructed? So freedom itself has been as well. I think initially, when we think about that term, if you think about, let's say, Paul, when he's talking about being free, freedom from slavery, and that's probably the most base kind of understanding of that word, of freedom. And as we've gotten, you know, gone on and post-industrial revolution and workers and all this kind of stuff, freedom started to mean something more along the lines of freedom from oppression, freedom from, you know, some type of class struggle or something like that. But really what it means now in today's society is it means a freedom from social norms. And I think you kind of see that. Because if you think about it, we've freed people from, and not we, but, you know, the society and people as a whole, have freed people from that slavery of their religion, from their community, their churches. We've freed people from their family obligations. If you think about, I see some of you guys here are older, there are certain freedoms that I have now, when I talk about social norms, that you didn't have when you were younger. I can legally divorce my wife, and there'll be zero repercussions for that legally. There will be no social, outside the church, there will be no social repercussions for that. No one will look down on me. No, I won't lose any jobs for that. That's not the way it's always been. And so, in that way, we're freer now than we've ever been. Look at Romans 6:20, and I'll try to hash this out, and then you guys can discuss a few things. In Romans 6:20, he said, "For when you were slaves of sin, you were free in regard to righteousness. What fruit did you have then in the things of which you are not ashamed? For the end of those things is death. But now, having been set free from sin and having become slaves of God, you have your fruit to holiness, and in the end, everlasting life. For the wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is eternal life." See, I had this idea that man was designed to enslave himself to something. And I thought about this the other day. Molly, I have a daughter, she's 8 months old, so she's doing this formula bottle thing. And so, of course, you can't just use tap water. So we have a bottled water, and we use a lot of it, so we just get one of those big jugs. And so I went in, I cut the seal on the bottom of the jug, I pulled out the tap, I put the bottle underneath, and nothing came out. I mean, it was open to the water, nothing, just no flow. And immediately I realized, well, the problem is I haven't invented the top of it. I need to poke a hole somewhere, because I can remove the water from this jug, but unless there's something to fill up that jug with, it's just going to create a vacuum and no water is going to come out. And that's the way our souls work. If Solomon removes his restraint to his God and says, "I'm not going to be constrained by these rules anymore," and he has to fill that with something. He's got to fill that with degeneracy. He's got to fill that with his sexual desires, with his wealth. But at the end, it's not going to fulfill him. You see this all the time. I talked earlier about being more in a not only a post-Christian society, in a post-atheist, more of a post-God society. I'm around a lot of atheist types, and I'm sure you guys too are at work and everything like that. these are the most religious people I've ever met in my life. Have you guys noticed that? They will grab onto something. They will grab onto anything, because if you take God out, whatever it is, it could be anything. It could be a humanitarian cause. It could be environment. It could be whatever it is. They are going to be absolutely fanatical religious about that. And the reason is that's because that's the way God designed our souls. He designed us that way. We have to be that way. I've never met anybody who wasn't that way. So if you haven't filled yourself up with some type of thing to, you have to have something to live for in order to even be somebody. And if not, you'll just find your people who will completely fill themselves with degeneracy the way that Solomon did. So what are the effects of some of that? You know, how do we move from this idea of just being freely constrained and why this obsession? And I think it could be even dangerous here in this inclined wood. And let me just kind of hash this out, this idea out. I think part of it is not just our society in general. About we have a very individualistic, atomized society, and that's one of the problems with this freedom notion. And people talk about freedom, and we become so atomized, and that and part of it is the country we live in, and where freedom has become the highest value, and to base your entire civilization on that and that alone is dangerous. I don't think we have the social cohesion that we once had, and we don't have the cohesion among our church that we once had. You know, when I was young, I used to come to Kleinwood every year. You know, and I would go to Southside for, like, I guess, you know, after camp they had this singing and stuff, and then I'd come to the Kleinwood singing too and everything like that. And in those days, you know, if you were to venture way up to Kleinwood, you were, you know, past the city, well past any type of this was out here, right? This used to be, you know, on the outskirts of the outskirts. And of course now we've seen the sprawl happen and everything like that. And I think that can be a dangerous thing for us if we're not careful, because, you know, some of us live 30 minutes, you know, east of here. Some of you guys live 30 minutes west of here. Well, that's an hour and a hour apart, and I can go to the store and not run into anybody. And in a way, that's freeing. I have that freedom. I don't have to, you know, I'm not bumping into the people I see at Sunday all the time. But at the same time, that's a little bit dangerous, because I don't have anybody that's going to hold me accountable for anything. And that's dangerous. And we need to realize this danger. Some of this stuff that can happen. I'm not all that convinced on the future of Christendom as a whole, if that's kind of the route that we're heading down, because even these like kind of mega churches, if there's one thing that they all have in common, what do they kind of focus on? And it's that personal relationship with Jesus Christ. You've heard that before. That's not in the Bible, and it's not the way God designed us. We're social beings. Every time that God dealt with his nation, he said, you know, I'm going to make a people, and we are his people, you know, and we're not supposed to just be individuals, you know, just running around kind of, and then once a week, every Sunday, coming together and kind of, you know, singing a few songs, and then I'll see you next week. This is a dangerous thing. So, in other words, this freedom has led to the destruction of many of our communities, our churches, and things like that. And so what do we do about that? So Solomon went wrong in that he ran away with freedom. He pulled that plug, the water started flowing out, and he filled it back up with the wrong stuff. So I think a group like this, a group of men like this that are going to be not only the present but the future of this church and the future of our movement, I think you have to go back and think about, there's a Greek saying that says, one man is no man, you know, basically saying that, you know, if you aren't living for someone else, you're not living at all. And that's the way Solomon, I think, what he realized, of course, later in life, and when he wrote this book, he realized that when I was only acquiring things for myself, when I was only fulfilling my own desires, that was vanity. And men have a special calling when it comes to this. Like I said before, men and women are completely different. They're not interchangeable. And if you just go back to the beginning of the Old Testament, from Adam, from Noah, his sons, Abraham, Moses, Joshua, and the 12 spies, all the way to Jesus and the 12 apostles, men have always been called to lead the charge on spreading the gospel, keeping the gospel alive. And so that's what we need to do. We need to start taking stock in each other's lives. We need to have something at stake with each other. And that's going to help us keep from living these vain, empty lives. In the Gospel of John, there's this, talks about the hired hand. And in John 10, he says, I'm the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays his life down for his sheep. The hired hand, who is not the shepherd and does not own the sheep, sees the wolf coming and leaves the sheep and runs away. And the wolf snatches and scatters them. You see, he's talking about this notion of this hired hand, this person who has no buy-in to his flock. And some of you know, I had this house that I rent out. It's in Florida, and it's in a popular, well, now it's more popular spring break vacation spot, and I rent it out. And I've had people ask me about that before and say, how do you do that? How could you let these kids, you know, come into this house that you've decorated, you put all these linen and everything, and you just let them come in there, and who knows what they do? And I try not to think about what they do, but I say I have no problem with it at all. You see, what you do is, you know, the type of person that's going to be renting your house in that certain time period, and you ask a large deposit from them, and then that way you know that that they have something at stake. They have, and that's what we need to have with each other: something at stake. Because the world doesn't have anything at stake. I think it's kind of crazy to we're always like shocked at all the things that go on. And it would be like me not asking any deposit. Some kids from LSU want to have their spring break at my house. I say, oh, yeah, just come on in. I trust you guys. I don't know you, but I'm sure you guys are good kids and everything like that. And then I walk in a week later, my house is torn to shreds, and I'm like, oh, I can't believe what happened here. This is just shocking. We can't be shocked when the world does what they do to us, because they have no stake. You know, we have to get over that. And so I truly believe that eventually, if we work with each other, we strengthen our bond. I think eventually that all that craziness will come about, and we'll have something here for whenever people wake up from their insanity that's out there. They'll have something to come back to.